The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So this is the first morning of the first day of our training period. Our three-week training period, and always something for me, and I think for all of us, to set off on such a great adventure. Whether we're just here for the morning, for a day or a week, or for 3 weeks, I think we are all headed into something that we cannot know. This thing that we cannot know is our life. We have all kinds of hopes and fears for what it might be, or opinions of how it should be or should not be. Here we come together to sit upright as we face into life itself, this life that is unpredictable, this life that is terrifying and wondrous, the great mystery. We join in with so many others. We might say we join in with all human beings who have ever lived. Especially we join in with our ancestors in the Zen Buddhist lineage. So many before us, going back 2,500 years to the Buddha, to look into this great matter of life and death. Come together with this intention to wake up, with this intention to look deeply. Every year here at the temple, our ninth time, we take 3 weeks of our retreat schedule. All day long sitting and walking, eating and resting, we look into this matter. And each year we begin with a text, some writings from our ancestors, those who have gone before us. Sometimes it's something from 8th or 9th century China, sometimes from contemporary teachers. This year we are looking into Lojong teachings, specifically through a book by a contemporary Zen teacher in the San Francisco lineage, Norman Fisher. And he's written quite a wonderful book called Training in Compassion, Zen Teachings on the Practice of Lojong. His book is a Zen approach to these teachings. These teachings are actually from the Tibetan tradition. The Tibetan Buddhism, another one of the great streams of the Mahayana, the great vehicle teaching of which Zen is a part. And these Lojong teachings come from a text written in the 12th century called The Root Text of the Seven Points of Training the Mind by Chikawa Yeshe Dorje, a great Tibetan teacher. He's looking back to a 10th century teaching by an Indian teacher named Atisha. These collection of slogans, 59 different entry points, we might say. These were designed to help us wake up to our life. And in Zen, we don't have any teachings that we call slogans, but in the Zen tradition, there are gathas or verses. Robert Aitken actually composed a wonderful book, I think called Something About the Green Dragon, but of these little verses to help us remember. Because one of the essential problems for us human beings, and especially those of us on the path to wake up, is that we forget. We have a good intention in the morning, but by lunchtime we've quite forgotten what that intention was, as we are swept away by the events of the day. So one of our great works on the spiritual path is to remember. And in fact, the root for the Pali word for mindfulness is the same root as the root to remember. To remember who we are. To remember what the stakes are. To remember what it is we really want. In our opening ceremony last night, we asked people to reflect on what is it that they really wanted, specifically thinking about these 3 weeks ahead, whether you're sitting here for these 3 weeks or living your life in the world. We are inviting everyone in this Sangha, and everyone hearing these words is part of this Sangha of practice. Each one of us listening here today or at some other time, because there is something that is calling to us, something deep in the heart that urges us to stop, to interrupt, we might say interrupt the mindless forward momentum of our life. It gathers momentum so quickly, the momentum of have to get it right, have to be good enough, have to succeed, have to have it a certain way. And that these 3 weeks and this moment right here is the opportunity to stop, to step out of the roaring river, this wild rush of life, and to bring our attention into this moment. This requires great intention. If you don't really want something, you won't stop. Sometimes we think, Buddhism says that wanting something is bad. But yet, as human beings, we have this bodhicitta, we say the way-seeking heart-mind. There is some part of us that has tasted and touched and been touched by life itself, a life that is beyond the usual categories. What category is there for the feeling of the rain on your cheeks? What words really are there for those moments when we are truly at home, when we realize this world and everything in it is our world, is your world. This great painful delusion of separation that we human beings suffer from so much, well, in one sense, true, each one of us living our own life, No one can do this work for you. You must set off on this great journey. And yet, at the same time, you have never been alone. There is no such thing as an individual human being. We are part of this great family of life, part of this great family of atoms and stars and birds and cars and raindrops. All of us interconnected with no gap at all. And sometimes we remember this, realize this, and then such sweetness and relief. And so these slogans, this Lojong actually means mind training. And the teaching is that we actually can and do need to train ourselves. In Zen, this is a dangerous concept because we say again and again there actually is no path. There is nowhere to go. What you are seeking is already here. You are already awake. This life right here is the awakened life. This is not a self-improvement project we are engaged in here. We are simply trying to wake up to what has always been true. And yet, if we don't sit ourselves on the cushion, if we don't look deeply into this moment, then the power of the thoughts and the momentum of the way things are is so strong that we're just swept away. And then we live in the world of thoughts and live in the world of this mental construction. So our Zazen, our sitting meditation, is one kind of training. My teacher, George Bowman, would always talk about retreats or sesshin as training periods. So we are training ourselves to meet this moment. We are training ourselves to be ourselves. We say cultivating this basic friendliness toward what arises. And this is all so easy to say. Many people think Zen is quite a wonderful thing, but many fewer people are willing to actually practice because the practice is quite terrible and fearsome and, of course, quite wonderful and so rich to set out on this journey to meet yourself. To meet your life, to be intimate with our lives. And this journey of intimacy is much different from the journey of getting what we want. Usually we just want what we want. We want to be calm. We want to be rich. We want to be wise. So we set out to get that as if we didn't have it already. And then we wander far from the true way. But how do we set out to be here? To cultivate this vow to be with what is here. This is a very different project than trying to feel good. The Buddha, in one of his discourses, talked about the eight worldly winds of gain and loss, fame and disgrace, blame and praise, pleasure and pain, And he said, those who have not awakened to their true nature are subject to these eight worldly winds. And those who have awakened to their true nature are subject to their eight worldly winds. These eight worldly winds. Sometimes we may think there is something called enlightenment, and once we get enlightened, we will not have to suffer. Many of us come to practice thinking that we can avoid suffering. And the path of practice says that suffering is unavoidable. But that how we meet the suffering of our life, the pain and the blame, the disgrace, the loss that is part of life, that how we meet that makes all the difference. And that this path of liberation is not liberation from difficulty. You can sit for many coming and going, Sashin. You can sit for years and decades, a whole lifetime, and still some days you'll feel open and clear, and other days you'll feel contracted and heavy. Some days you will cry and some you will laugh. Some days you'll be centered, some days you'll be off-center. And these slogans, these 59 sayings, are entry points, each one of them some way into life itself. And Pema Chodron, the great Tibetan teacher, has actually written a book on these, on Lojong teachings, and she talks about the slogan practice, and she said, it helps me, they help me transform all circumstances into the path of enlightenment. This path and our path of awakening is about transforming all circumstances into the path of enlightenment. This is not transforming the quality of them or the content of them, but practicing this very courageous way of entering into what's here, rather than sorting and trying to get more peacefulness and less disturbance. What we are practicing is meeting whatever arises as the way itself. And Norman Fisher says in particular, this is about turning difficulty into benefit. Turning difficulty into benefit. In this path, then, the difficulty we encounter is not a mistake. And this very difficulty, as we creatively engage in it, creatively engage in the moment, it becomes a resource. And then we can cultivate this freedom, and the freedom is to be where we are and to use what is here. So when difficulty is here, we use difficulty. And if our difficulty and if our struggle can be, is a resource, then all of us are quite rich. We have an inexhaustible resource. What is here in this moment? And so over these next 3 weeks, we'll be taking one by one these slogans. We won't deal with all of them, but the first week we'll deal with the first section, and the next week with the middle, and the third week with the end. But there's no path here of 1, 2, 3, 4, but simply taking these slogans. So if you're reading Norman Fisher's book, or if you have other access, or just looking at the slogans themselves, would encourage you, encourage us all to dive into one of them, one at a time. And in Norman Fisher's book, he talks about working with these slogans, and he said, in working with them, it always begins with body and breath. We have this root practice of being present in the moment, being present with the sensations and thoughts and emotion, sitting in an upright and dignified posture. So we have this as part of where we begin to work with the slogans. You can, if you wish, repeat the slogan silently to yourself again and again, whatever it is. One of them is be grateful to everyone. One is turn all mishaps into the path, whatever it is. But just gently repeat that, silently repeat that to yourself. He says, reflect lightly on it. Working with these slogans is not about intellectual analysis and furrowing your brow and working hard, but rather holding this as we might hold some slogan or some words that come to us from the sutra book or in a koan. We hold it lightly. Breathe it in and out. We notice what arises. We might read some of someone's commentary on this to enter more deeply into this or that. We just see what arises through the day, through our life, through our practice. Like putting on a pair of glasses and looking this way and then that way. So here on retreat, to have whatever root practice you have, being with the breath, open awareness, working with koans, and that as it feels right to you to work in these slogans that will be in the different Dharma talks and also on your own as you wish to look through these. And in this way, we'll work with them in a rather disorganized manner, which is one of our styles in Zen. Each one of these is the whole teaching. When we truly encounter one part of the world, when we truly meet our experience without opinion, meeting the suchness of the moment, then there is no gap between yourself and yourself. And the koan of you is resolved. Just in the walking, just in the eating, just in struggling in the darkness. Whatever place you are, you find that this is the life of all worlds, the great generosity of life has given itself to you, gives itself to you moment after moment. We all here together, here in the meditation hall and wherever here is for whoever is listening to this, we join in together this great loving practice, this training practice, training ourselves to open our heart mind to this moment. This is how we grow in wisdom and compassion. So wonderful to be setting out together here. Thank you. So in a moment we'll go around and say our names and have our Dharma dialogue, and this talk is being recorded, and if there's something you'd like to say or a question you'd like to ask that you'd like not to be recorded, let us know and we'll simply turn off the recorder. So I'm David.
And I'm Melissa, and also please feel free to be comfortable in your seat.
I'm Mike.
I'm Camden.
I'm Jenny.
Sandra.
I'm Chloe.
Red.
Noah.
Fabian.
And Alan.
And Jessica.
So this is the time for questions about the talk or about practice, about Lojong, whatever's on your mind, questions or comments, what's arising for you as we set off here, as you hear these reflections. Yeah.
I appreciated that you mentioned the raindrops. When I was taking the food offering up after breakfast, I walked under the hemlock tree and my head hit the and the fell down on me, and then it got lighter and it bounced up and hit some more. It kind of made a raindrop avalanche, and I just laughed. It was like the tree.
Yeah, the tree.
Here we are.
Wonderful. Greeting you. That's good. Yeah, those moments, I think we can't fabricate them, but when we start paying attention, the world is dousing us all the time.
So I really appreciate the way that you jumped right into the seeming contradiction between our tradition, our Zen tradition, and this really interesting Tibetan teaching that we're encountering. And some of the, you know, Tibetan-oriented books about it call this training the mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, and our tradition almost starts with someone saying, you know, I can't pacify my mind, and then the Dharma says, oh, well, bring it to me. You know, I can't find it.
Yeah.
You know, so how do we train something that we can't find? How do we train something that does not exist? So I'm not saying this to criticize the Tibetan tradition at all, but just to invite you to maybe even say a little bit more about how paradoxical and rich this paradox is for us.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, the wonderful thing about all Buddhist practices is that they're many and varied, and human beings are many and varied. So there's a teaching that permeates all of Buddhism called upaya, which means skillful means. So there are some people who the correct entry point for them at some point in their lives is to enter through the mind. That's just... And also just to be careful about the use of the English word mind, which often is used to translate citta, which means heart mind. So we're talking about, you know, something, not just the brain, right? Not just thinking, but also feeling. And so there are many, many practices throughout all the Buddhist traditions that are a good fit for a particular person. And in Zen practice, even in Zen practice, we as teachers try to find a practice that someone could enter without too much difficulty at first. And then when they're ready for more difficulty, then we know that and give them more to do. So in some ways, this practice can be useful for us. I think it's really great when our minds really are lost and confused. It's a wonderful way to orient them, and like koan practice, they appear to engage the mind, and really those of us who were here last night and we read them, and we'll be doing that every day in the afternoon, or at least many days. They contradict each other, you know, and we could hear that. You know, there'd be this thing like you know, it's this way, and then another one would say, well, it's really not that way, and on and on and on. So they actually, I always do simultaneous translation with other traditions, and what I'm hearing in training the mind is undoing the mind, which is a perfect fit for us.
Yeah. And I love what you say about our koan tradition. So in a sense, I think we're taking these up, each one, as a koan, like we take the precepts, which seem pretty straightforward, you know, don't kill. Well, you know, so many levels, and you know, so be grateful to everyone. Well, yeah, okay, so we could look at that at so many levels, but this openness and being willing to be led beyond what we know. So thanks.
Thanks for your talk. Thanks. So coming back here is such an experience. My goodness, like walking back in the training Zendo and oh my goodness. It's on. I like what you were saying about confusion. And because there's something really valuable that feels there for me as well. But it's such a hard emotion to not want to throw in the dumpster and get rid of, like, as soon as it arises. And so I, you know, how, and I was doing some of the, I was reading some of this book last night, and, you know, this harsh judgment or the harsh analyzing, you know, I wasn't softly reflecting. I was like, oh, yeah. Didn't work. But I'm just curious, like, more about the confusion, and how we can get out of it being so harsh or so difficult.
Yeah, Mike's really an expert on confusion.
I live in it.
That's kind of the answer. For me, anyway. So we of course don't always live in it, but sometimes it does arise in a painful way, in a way where we thought we had clarity, or where something becomes evident to us that we haven't wanted to acknowledge in ourselves, or and then we see it and think, oh, this is the judge arises, and then confusion, and then how do I work with this, and we can watch this incredible kind of mind state arise and really disorganize us. And I think the inclination is to think, oh, this is terrible. My practice is going quite badly. But that's practice. This disorganization, I think, is actually not bad. It really presents an opportunity for us. You know, I think we can be gentle, and it's not to try to throw ourselves into this pit of despair, but sometimes things arise, and so, you know, I would have said, you know, practicing perfectly, you know, you just mentioned not going well, no, going exactly right, you know, throwing your heart into the question, thrown by it, confused, uncertain. This is part of our tradition, and I think, you know, it sounds bad when you hear it, but really, you know, a gateway. You know, this is also liberation taking place.
Yeah. Well, and I like what you say about wanting to throw it in the dumpster, right? Because we all have places, mind spaces that arise for us that we just want to get rid of it. Right? For some people it's confusion, for some it may be sadness, for others anxiety. You know, what is it that when it arises you want to throw it in the dumpster? And this whole practice is in some way saying that that is your resource. So if you have an abundance of confusion, this is the resource that you must use.
Can I tag on? You have said to before, and you were quoting someone, I can't remember who, your I think it's terrible karma is your wondrous dharma.
Right. Mm-hmm. Becomes your wondrous
dharma.
Right. Okay.
So it's not just hearing it isn't upsetting, it's also experiencing it is upsetting. So the willingness to go into the upset and not ride over it. And get to know it really, really well.
Right.
You know, it won't transform until you stop fighting it and running away from it. And those are the two things we want to do with the unpleasant. Mm. Yeah. One of our Dharma teachers the other night gave a talk where he said that if you really want to engage in Zen, you're going to be disturbed and upset. And then used his own life to talk about that. And I think that's right. Not at first. At first it's kind of nice. Everything goes along, beautiful breath practice. And then wait a minute, these things, if we're truly to meet them. Wait a minute, is this what I signed on for? And I think this is what David was talking about. Zen sounds great until you've been practicing it for a while. And that's why it's not the most popular religion on the planet.
And he talks, he calls this training in compassion. And so he talks about whatever we meet, the training is, can I be compassionate? So when I meet harshness, can I open my heart to the harshness that is in me? And it, of course, it's wherever you find it, because we can be harsh with our harshness. Right? And then can I be compassionate with being harsh with my harshness? And the phrase he uses in the book, I think that is, you won't have to read the whole book, just this one phrase. What he says to himself and what I say to myself when it's going really badly and I'm really disappointed in myself. The phrase is, this is how human beings feel sometimes. This is how human, because usually I think I'm wrong, I don't want to feel this, but wow, this is how human beings feel, and I do want to be compassionate, like you, like all of us. So can I be compassionate with this human being who feels like this, right here? Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
I like what you said when I first came in about just like being with where you're at, and I was like, oh, feeling like, okay, I can just feel relief. I don't have to fix anything or change anything. And then you were talking about, you know, suffering and not coming here to self-improve and. And then I found myself getting angry, and I had this argument, and I was like, well, wait a minute, I understand that, but what about needless suffering? That's what I'm coming from. I'm going to suffer, but I come here to try to quiet down the needless suffering. So I'm like, I'm going to get in an argument. But there's like everything that you're saying is good news, bad news. And like I'm feeling, because I don't want the suffering. Ultimately, I only want the good news. But I do have the question of like, I mean, I come here to try to help with the needless suffering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because if there's something I'm doing and responding, you know,
right?
Yeah. I am trying to get something.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
One of the things we were talking about recently among the teachers is the idea of harboring suffering or harboring ill will, which I think is the similar thing that you're talking about. So we can't avoid suffering. It just arises. And we can't avoid anger, sadness, fear, physical difficulties in the body. We can't avoid those things. One of the things that we do and that I think Zen really trains us out of is we see the narrative that keeps that suffering going. And that's what you're pointing to. And that is needless. And it has to do with holding on to. We find out how tight we're holding on to suffering. And that when we see that, one of the chants in the book says that awareness is its own action. Because in that moment of seeing what's happening, how we're harboring, holding the narrative tight to us to keep perpetuating this, right? Then it doesn't just automatically drop and we're fine. But something, some spaciousness enters the field. And in that spaciousness, the suffering can transform. It doesn't necessarily transform, but it can. But if we do this other kind of modern 21st century psychological training in, oh, I see that this suffering is needless and that is, you know, unavoidable. So the needless one, I'm just going to get rid of it. Then it just, boing, comes back to us. You've had that experience, right? And every one of us has ultimately had that experience. It only works so far, you know, and then it just comes back. So, and it's that unwanted guest, you know, the friend. It just keeps coming. And if we haven't befriended it, then we'll just be caught in a push-pull for the rest of our lives. So the work is to recognize it and to see how we're part of the holding on pattern. And this is, you know, opening the hand of thought. We use that phrase based on another teacher's work. So the hand opens and things then have the possibility of movement. But we don't throw away. We don't put it in the dumpster. Because, man, if we put it in the dumpster overflows and it's still with us and we're carrying it on our backs for the rest of our lives. Oh, it's a lot. It weighs a lot. It's so heavy. Mm. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. And these are just different ways of framing that teaching that you know is true, because that's why you got angry about it. You know this.
Yeah. And there, this training, he says, and the Buddha said, there really is a way to move through our life with less suffering, to meet what we encounter in some new way, to meet everything. And that's, that's what you know. And that really is something to want. Right. I want that. Right. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So for me, I've been thinking about how some of the ancient teachings feel like skillful means. They feel like if we make certain choices, then we will be less likely to suffer. And I think there are ways that when we have a choice, we can make a choice. And I think that's something that you're probably acknowledging. You know, so if I eat food that makes me feel terrible and just do it again and again and again, I might be able to make a different choice there and suffer less. So there are some places in life where through being awake, we can realize those things and actually make different choices. And that, so there's a benefit, like a self-improvement outcome thing that's in there, right? But I think for us, the heart of the teaching is something even richer than that, which is that that's possible, and those are all good things that should be done. And then what about all those places where nothing can be done? Like getting old, getting sick, losing people we love. These are the things that also really make us suffer, and there's nothing we can do about those types of things. And so there's a practicing with vast confusion arising. It just arises out of the encounter with life. And then in that moment, there's the possibility of realizing that this is it too, that this is the way, that this is also life. And David's saying, meeting it compassionately, that just it softens, it dissolves. We can see into it, we can see through it, and yet it still is arising. So this idea that we need to get rid of it has not helped me. I can't, because that's life. But I can practice with it. I can stay curious about it. And that for me is the value of these phrases. They make me curious. It's like shining a light on all these different places in life so that they become apparent and I can see them as they actually are, which is empty and real. It's very subtle and hard to talk about, but there's liberation in that.
Last one.
Personally, I cannot avoid the narrative. And I find some way just being one with this wonderful human storyteller.
Just Yeah.
Right. Well, it's very similar to what we're saying, that this is what's arising, the story.
Right.
So if you try to not tell stories, then that's impossible. Right. But to see that you're actually telling a story is so important, that you're stringing together different events and memories into a coherent narrative, something that makes sense. And just see it. Just see it. You know, just like confusion is arising, anger is arising. You see this, you know it, you're aware. That's all you have to do. You don't have to throw the narrative in the dumpster either.
Mm. And to bring compassion.
Yes. Yes, so important. Yeah. I think we need to get a dumpster here. And then, tell people, don't throw things.
All right, well, let's sit for another breath and then we'll move into walking meditation.